Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 27th of July, these are our main stories. Guatemala agrees to a migration deal with the US. The US Army's top general has said he's cautiously optimistic about peace talks in Afghanistan. And pro-democracy protests at Hong Kong's airport stretched late into Friday night. Also in this podcast, Kenya's forthcoming census will allow people to identify as intersex.
Actually, I cannot express my happiness because as per now, it seems like intersex does not exist.
And Russians urge their government to fight fires raging in Siberia. The White House has announced that the US and Guatemala have reached an agreement on limiting asylum applications. The news came 3 days after Donald Trump threatened Guatemala with tariffs. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office, Mr. Trump welcomed the agreement.
We've been dealing for many years, I would say, with Guatemala and with other countries, and we are now at a point where we are, we just get along, and they're doing what we've asked them to do, and I think it's going to be a great thing for Guatemala. They don't want these problems either. So we were able to get this done, and we got it done fairly quickly.
I've been hearing more from our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler.
What must be pointed out is that Guatemala, in its statement, has been pretty vague about the specifics and even not specifically said what it had signed in terms of this claim of a safe third country agreement. Now, just to explain exactly what that is, essentially it means that migrants who travel through Guatemala from Honduras and El Salvador, many of whom have been coming to the United States border, would have to claim asylum in Guatemala before they reach the US. Essentially, they would have to claim for protection in the first country that they reached. And that's something that American officials have been pushing for time and time again because of the pressure at its southern border. The big question, though, about this is that the courts in Guatemala had suggested that Congress would need to give approval for any such deal. And currently, Congress isn't sitting because it's a summer recess. And it's not quite clear how the government has got around this, but President Trump insists that this deal puts this in place, that this agreement is going to go ahead.
This is regarded, isn't it, by the Americans or the Trump administration as a safe third country, yet it's one of the poorest countries in the world.
Oh, yeah. And there are huge problems in Central America. And there is a danger of just saying that that's just in El Salvador, just in Honduras. The problems go to Guatemala, too. And what's important here is that those who are fleeing those countries can be fleeing many things. It can be corruption. It can be violence. But one of the big problems is poverty. And of course, there are people who are going through Mexico from Guatemala to the US border as well. The issue for the US has been to try to get the countries that they go through. So, for example, in the case of Guatemalans going through Mexico, the US has been arguing that as far as they're concerned, that they should claim asylum in Mexico before they reach the US border. The problem is to try and keep it away from the US border. That's what American officials have been trying to do. But the reality is, as long as the problems exist in Central America, as long as those problems are not being tackled there, then people are going to still come.
And what's in this, if anything, for people claiming asylum in Guatemala?
Well, there are arguments here that, first of all, there's going to be a positivity for people who want to come from Guatemala in order to work as farm workers. There is a feeling in the US that some of those migrants who have been coming across the border in order to work on ranches, they are very valuable. And this will make it easier for them as far as this deal is concerned. But it's got to be said, you know, there's a little bit of carrot and there's a little bit of stick here as well, because President Trump had been threatening tariffs. He had been threatening to try and charge Guatemala. And perhaps that all goes away now, but I suspect the problems with the border won't.
Chris Buckler in Washington. The US military's top general has expressed cautious optimism about efforts to reach a negotiated end to the war in Afghanistan. Speaking after visiting Kabul, General Joseph Dunford said the American envoy to Afghanistan was now engaged in a fairly robust dialogue with the Taliban. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, reports.
General Dunford said the US hadn't seen progress like this in the entire time its forces had been deployed in Afghanistan. He was referring to 7 rounds of talks between the Taliban and the US envoy Zalmay Khalilzad. A deal is now said to be all but done. It would include the departure of foreign troops in exchange for security guarantees. Most of all, a commitment that Afghanistan would not be used again as a safe haven for extremist groups. This week, General Dunford and Ambassador Khalilzad had crucial meetings in Kabul to try to reassure Afghan leaders that the US was not rushing to the exit. US officials insist their deal will also include a ceasefire and the start of the first formal talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. There's great scepticism, but also rare hope. Jonathan Powell, who was a key player in the Northern Ireland peace process, is now involved in efforts to bring peace to Afghanistan.
I think this is the best opportunity to get to peace, where you have all of the relevant powers engaged. So the Taliban are willing to talk to the Americans. They're groping their way to sitting down with the Afghan government. And also Pakistan, who's a key player in this war and in this negotiation. Imran Khan and General Bajwa have just been to Washington, and they've made it very clear that they will cooperate with the Americans in trying to get to a peace agreement.
Many players will need to be involved if this push for peace is to have any chance of success. But if this week's discussions move the process forward, an historic first round of formal Afghan talks involving the government and the Taliban could get underway as early as next month. It would mark an important start. But Afghans fear that real peace is still a long way off.
Lise Doucette, let's take you to Hong Kong now. Where throughout Friday, thousands of protesters filled the arrivals hall of the international airport. Flight attendants and airport staff also took part in a protest against the police's slow response to last weekend's attacks, allegedly by triad gangs, on pro-democracy demonstrators. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell was at the airport.
So where I'm standing right now is the arrivals hall of Hong Kong International Airport, where there are people all around me in their thousands dressed in black and supporting the pro-democracy movement. This started off as a much smaller gathering and has grown as the afternoon's drawn on, as more people have joined in. Basically, it's organised by staff working at the airport with the assistance of the unions, like the Cathay Pacific Flight Attendants Union, the Baggage Handlers Union. Not only are they calling for democracy in Hong Kong, but criticising the violence last weekend of the gangs who attacked pro-democracy activists on their way home. Now, they're calling for an inquiry into this, saying why were the police not there? Because they believe that at least some of the officers have been colluding with those mafia gangs in order to try and crush the spirit of this pro-democracy movement. And apart from all of those things, obviously by having this protest at the airport, it's an exercise in getting the message out to a much wider audience. So everybody who is flying into Hong Kong today, from whichever part of the world they are, cannot avoid realising that there is a political crisis here. I mean, you get off the plane, you clear customs, you're pushing through with your cases, and you have to go through a tunnel of people chanting, "Free Hong Kong, free Hong Kong." Now, we spoke to the staff of several airlines who've taken part in this protest, and here's some of what they had to say.
Everything happens about our governments, between the police and the mob, happening on the 21st of July, that was making me very angry. And I really, really urge people to continue to see what happening in Hong Kong.
And what do you think of the strategy of having a protest at the airport? Why is it a good idea?
Because in the airport, there was the first impressions for all the people coming into Hong Kong. So we want the world to know what's happening in Hong Kong. This is the only way we can make ourselves very clear. The 5 warns that we wanted, none of them being answered by the government. And we can't see where we are going.
Do you think the pro-democracy protesters will win?
We know we are going to lose, but we will fight till the end, because this is our last chance. And sorry, I'm a bit emotional. This is the really last chance for Hong Kong, seriously, because I have a kid. I can't bear with my son, 3-year-old, living under the darkness of the whole communist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, why have you come along to protest here today?
This thing isn't right. One person, one vote. That's democracy. We have the right to assemble, and the government is not listening to the people. 2 million people come out to the street and protest peacefully, and you're not responding to the people.
Do you think that most people in this movement now want one person, one vote, and they won't settle for anything less?
I think that's what a lot of people want, to actually have a leader that is voted by the people.
BBC's Stephen McDonnell with that report. Now, as the European heatwave continues, reports from Greenland show the world's second largest ice sheet is melting at an alarming rate. This is due to hot air moving up from northern Africa and higher temperatures in the Arctic. Ruth Mottram is a climate scientist and glaciologist at the Danish Meteorological Institute. I asked her what's causing this phenomenon.
We've seen a very warm and persistently warm summer temperature. In fact, since April, we've had new record temperatures, especially in Western Greenland, and that has really led to a lot of melting, much more melting than we would expect to see at this time of year. It is important to say July is summer in Greenland. We do expect to get a lot of melting at this time of year, but we've certainly seen a lot more than the average.
Have you been shocked by what you've seen?
It's been a little bit surprising that because we've sort of expected it, but, you know, normally in the summertime in Greenland, you'll get periods of melt and then periods without very much melt. But this year, it's just been going on and on and on for weeks. We've had really very persistent melting, and that's quite surprising. We have not yet reached the total melt that we saw in 2012, for example, which was a record year. We may actually meet that next week. So we're keeping a very close eye on it at the moment.
Just give us some figures. How much of the ice has gone?
I was out of the office for the last 3.5 weeks, and when I came back to my desk and did a quick calculation, I could see that we've lost about 160 billion tonnes of ice in the last 3.5 weeks. So since the beginning of July, basically, which is really a lot. It's 100 billion tonnes more than we would expect. But, I mean, it's very difficult to understand what that number means. It's about 64 million Olympic-sized swimming pools. It adds about 0.7 millimetres to sea level rise globally if you spread it out around the world's oceans. So it's really a lot of water.
Are we going to be seeing more of this?
Yes, I think we will. And one of the things that's a little bit concerning about what's going on in Greenland right now is that sort of in the past, climate models have suggested that these kind of melt rates will not occur at this point in time, but maybe towards the end of the century under high emissions scenarios. And so to see it happening right now means that maybe we have to revise those projections in the future.
And is there anything anyone can do to try to slow this down?
Well, it's very clear that temperature and ice melting in Greenland is very closely related to global temperature. So if we can keep global climate change from exceeding the Paris targets, for example, then that will actually reduce the amount of ice that's being lost from Greenland. But it is a very complex system, and the warming that is built into the system already will lead to melt anomalies in the future.
Ruth Mottram from the Danish Meteorological Institute. Now, still to come on this podcast, a man who once stopped a cyber attack on Britain's National Health Service is spared further jail time by a US court after pleading guilty to cyber crimes.
The judge said the details of his crimes paled in comparison to the foresight he'd shown in stopping the WannaCry virus.
And Britain's media regulator has fined Russia's state-funded broadcaster for breaking the rules of impartial reporting. Before that, hundreds of fires are raging across the Arctic regions of northern Scandinavia, Greenland, Alaska and Siberia. And the Russian public is urging its government to act. Vitaly Shevchenko from the BBC's Russian service has been speaking to my colleague Ben James.
Huge parts of Siberia is engulfed in flames. We're talking about roughly 15,000 square kilometres, which is more than the whole of Montenegro or Northern Ireland. So it's really huge, and an even larger territory is suffocating in smoke produced by the fires. Now, what's interesting is that the Russian authorities are not tackling the majority of those fires. They argue that the cost of fighting them would be bigger than the damage caused. And what I've got here is a printout from a Russian website It's a map of Siberia covered in red blobs. Now, these are fires, and it's a very visual way to demonstrate how big the problem is.
Certainly is. There's red and orange blobs all the way across that map that you hold up in front of me. So are there many people living in this place? When people think Siberia, they perhaps have an image of somewhere that's very cold and very empty.
Well, on the one hand, it's a huge place, so the distances are vast and the forests are vast, and not many people live there. Having said that, there are several cities that are equally big. For example, Novosibirsk is in Siberia and it's Russia's third largest city. Also, places like Irkutsk, they've been affected by both the fires and the floods. So it's a double whammy. And the floods this year, they're the worst on record. More than two dozen people have been killed so far. So there's a lot of discussion going on social media, for example, about what's going on. And people are saying, look, whatever it costs you, put out the fires because we're suffocating. And also, you know, poor animals. One Twitter user in Russia said, just thinking about them is painful.
And I know for sure from talking to people in Russia last year at the World Cup in Moscow that the natural heritage of Russia is something that's pretty important to people who live there, that the natural beauty of the country. Is this anything to do with some of the heat wave stories we've been talking about here in Western Europe over the past few days? Has there been a heat wave in Siberia too?
Well, it's a very important point to make. Environmentalists have been mentioning climate change and global warming, but that's one concept that's missing from state TV coverage, and that's generated a lot of discussion itself. People are saying because oil and gas still constitute a huge part of Russia's export revenue, perhaps officials do not think it's such a great idea to talk about hydrocarbons and the problems they cause for the environment because they're selling them.
Vitaly Shevchenko speaking to the BBC's Ben James. The media regulator here in Britain has fined the Russian government-funded international broadcaster RT $250,000 for breaching impartiality rules. The body Ofcom has also instructed RT to broadcast a summary of its findings. Danny Eberhard is our Europe regional editor.
Ofcom says RT was guilty of serious failures in seven news and current affairs programmes broadcast last year. They related, it said, mainly to the Syrian conflict and the poisoning of the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and others in Salisbury. Broadcasters, it noted, were legally obliged to respect impartiality on major matters of political controversy or public policy, reflecting alternative views. RT called it very wrong that Ofcom should issue findings that are currently subject to a judicial review. It also called the fine disproportionate. The matter is likely to further strain relations between the two countries.
Danny Eberhard. Well, in 2017, a young man in Britain was celebrated for stopping a massive cyber attack on the National Health Service. But on Friday, Marcus Hutchins was in a court in the US state of Wisconsin, where he was sentenced to time already served for cyber crimes. Mr. Hutchins had pleaded guilty to writing and selling to criminals software that intercepted victims' bank details. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue covered the proceedings.
Judge Stattmuller told Hutchins that he would be sentenced to time served, in effect releasing him and allowing him to return to the UK. There were tears from some family members inside courtroom 425. Afterwards, Hutchins thanked the judge for what he called his incredible leniency. 2 years ago, Hutchins was a hero. He'd been credited with stopping the biggest cyber attack ever to hit the UK's National Health Service. Thanks to that, the judge said, the details of his crimes paled in comparison to the foresight he'd shown in stopping the WannaCry virus. The judge also raised the option of a pardon, something that could only happen if the president granted it.
Gary O'Donoghue. The United Nations has said nearly 2% of the global population has intersex traits, meaning they were born with a combination of physical characteristics that don't match the traditional concept of the male or female body. Well, a growing number of governments around the world are taking steps to officially recognise this segment of the population. And now Kenya has announced that its census next month will offer respondents a chance to identify as intersex. Hassan Aruni spoke to Ryan, an intersex activist who campaigned for this census policy.
Actually, I cannot express my happiness knowing like intersex for the first time will be recognized, because as per now, it seems like intersex does not exist. The reason why I'm saying this is because not even a single document that is showing is true intersex people do exist. But with this, it will help to know how many and where are they.
What sort of difference do you think this will make?
First of all, it will help creating awareness. And also this will help the government to plan. And also we as activists, it will help to know exactly how many we are in the country.
And when it comes to the census itself, do you think people like yourself might be anxious about marking themselves as intersex on the census?
One thing I know, when they see the questionnaire that they are having, instead of the binary system we have been using, male and female, we have the third category, they will feel free. Because as per now, the fear is what will happen next after disclosing. Because not even the biological parent who understand. And if you are a parent having an intersex kid, you are not comfortable saying or admitting it's true you have an intersex kid because of the fear of stigma. But when you see the state itself have recognized and they have indicated it's true, these are normal human beings and we need to know how many they are, they will feel that's a way of building their confidence. As an activist, what I'm doing is to talk to the people that I know and to tell them this is our time, because this will help the government now to put the policies and guidelines to help them feel like normal human beings.
It's very important you've raised this last point, because I want to find out from somebody like yourself, how does it feel growing up as an intersex person in your society?
First of all, you feel like you are not a human because you are being treated as a curse. Not even a single person who wants to associate with you. And I can say the most painful thing in this world is when you feel you are all alone. No one is caring and no one is loving you.
Ryan there, a Kenyan intersex activist speaking to Hassan Aruni. The climate change activist movement Extinction Rebellion, best known for shutting down parts of central London to traffic in April, has had some of its artefacts acquired by the prestigious Victoria and Albert Museum here in London. They'll go on display this weekend. Fahana Dawood reports.
A green, blue and pink flag printed with the movement's distinct symbol of extinction, an angular hourglass in a circle. Two printing blocks used by activists. Protest banners and an already rare pamphlet from the group's first print run are just some of the objects that will join the V&A's permanent collections. While a child's high-vis jacket, worn during an Extinction Rebellion protest, will go on display at the V&A's Museum of Childhood as part of a display about how the movement has engaged with families. The museum said the group's protests have a visual character and identity that is singular, a considered set of design choices that bring joy but also a focused sense of purpose. A senior curator said the design approach could be compared to the suffragettes, who similarly relied on a limited colour palette of green, white and purple to visually communicate their cause.
That was Fahana Dawood. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, then you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.